On radio, online and mobile. You're with SBS Radio.
This is SBS World News Radio. I'm Sasha Payne.
And I'm Mike Tomalaris. Coming up tonight, cyber hackers steal sensitive defence data, but the government admits it still doesn't know who's responsible.
The very fact that people who shouldn't have had access to this information got access should ring alarm bells in the government.
Also tonight, international university students to face tough new English standards.
This is about protecting international students and ensuring that they get the education and training they deserve.
And we'll hear the latest from the final day of the High Court hearing into the dual citizenship saga.
Those stories and more in the next 30 minutes.
Good evening. It's 6 o'clock with the news. I'm Michael Tomalaris. The federal government insists secret technical information hacked about new fighter jets and Navy vessels was not classified military information, but was rather commercially sensitive. It also admits it still doesn't know who did the hacking. The incident occurred in July last year, with a small aerospace engineering company targeted. Labor leader Bill Shorten has accused the coalition of not taking the security of national defence systems seriously.
If we got lucky this time and it was only sensitive information, not even more significant information, we need to make sure there is no next time. The government needs to wake up to itself, start taking its responsibilities seriously, and start protecting sensitive defence information.
New English language standards for international university students will be introduced next year. The standards will also be extended to vocational education and training courses. English language intensive courses for overseas students will have to formally assess the English language ability of students, where they provide direct entry to a tertiary course. Education Minister Simon Birmingham says the new policy is designed to stop students from falling through the cracks.
Some just don't have the English language skills they need to succeed. It means they draw away from getting involved in lectures or tutorials or group work while their classmates and teachers struggle to bridge the language divide. It's not fair to those international students, to the Australian students studying alongside them, or to their teachers, for them not to be given the skills they need to succeed.
The federal opposition is broadly supporting the changes, but says the government needs to ensure they can fund it without having to cut other education services. Lawyers for One Nation Senator Malcolm Roberts have told the High Court it would be un-Australian to discriminate between immigrants and people born in Australia during his defence of the senator's election to Parliament. 3 days of hearings into the eligibility of seven politicians embroiled in a dual citizenship saga wrapped up today. Australia's constitution bans dual nationals from sitting in Parliament to guard against split allegiances. Deputy Prime Minister Barnaby Joyce and his Nationals colleague Fiona Nash and Matt Canavan have all argued they should be spared the court's wrath, as has crossbench Senator Nick Xenophon. But the lawyer for former Green Senator Scott Ludlam and Larissa Waters have argued the other five ought to follow in the pair's footsteps and resign. The Commonwealth says Mr. Roberts and Mr. Ludlam should be disqualified because they were on notice about their status, as they were both born overseas. And speaking of overseas, firefighters in California are facing a resurgence of high winds as they struggle to halt wildfires that have killed at least 23 people, destroyed 3,500 structures, and left hundreds missing across the state's wine region. Nearly two dozen blazes spanning eight counties have charred around 70,000 hectares. Flames erupted on Sunday night when gale force winds toppled power lines and were then spread by hot, dry winds. More than 20,000 people remain under evacuation. The death toll, which includes an elderly couple, marks the greatest loss of life from a California wildfire event in almost 30 years. The state's governor, Jerry Brown, says the tragedy provides an opportunity to prepare for future disasters.
It's going to cost a lot of money. The president has declared disaster, major disaster, and along with the other ones in Texas and Florida and elsewhere, this will be tens of billions. So we got to get ready to deal with this situation and then prepare for others that will follow in the years to come.
Spain has given Catalan leaders 5 days to clarify whether it has declared independence and, if it has, another 3 days to rescind the claim. If it doesn't, the Spanish government says it will suspend Catalonia's political autonomy and rule the region directly, which it can do under Section 155 of the Spanish Constitution. Catalan President Carlos Puigdemont announced on Tuesday that he was using the victory in a banned October 1 referendum to proceed with a declaration of Catalan independence. Spain's Prime Minister, however, Mariano Rajoy, announced the ultimatum.
We've held a cabinet meeting and we've decided the Catalan government must confirm whether or not they have declared independence, regardless of whether it's going to take effect or not. This is a requirement necessary before any other measures can be taken by the government, including invoking Article 155.
The international community has urged both sides to honour Spain's constitution. And finally, a look at tomorrow's weather for Friday in Perth. Mostly sunny, warm, a top of 31 degrees. In Adelaide, a possible shower, 21. Melbourne, similar conditions, but 18 degrees the max. Hobart becoming cloudy, 16 degrees. In Canberra, mostly sunny, 22. In Sydney, a late shower or two, a top of 24. Newcastle, partly cloudy, 23. Brisbane, a shower or two, 27. In Cairns, partly sunny, 31. And Darwin, mostly sunny, 35 degrees. And Sasha, more on these stories can be seen and heard coming up on SBS World News at 6:30 tonight.
Thanks, Tomo. Across Australia, this is SBS World News Radio. It's 7 minutes after six. I'm Sasha Payne. Well, as you heard in the news, the three-day High Court hearing on the eligibility of seven federal politicians has come to a close in Canberra. The court is deciding whether Deputy Prime Minister Barnaby Joyce and six senators breached Section 44 of the Constitution by failing to renounce their foreign citizenship. If they did, they could be kicked out of Parliament. SBS World News reporter James Elton Pym has been at the High Court and I spoke to him a short time ago.
Today was the first time that one of the seven politicians who are caught up in this dual citizenship saga actually showed up at the court. Malcolm Roberts, the One Nation senator, walked into the court this morning, accompanied by one of his advisers, and he watched on today as his legal team tried to convince the panel of High Court judges that he should be allowed to keep his seat in the Senate. That's despite a High Court hearing in Brisbane last month confirming that Malcolm Roberts was British when he signed up as a candidate. But today, Malcolm Roberts' lawyer was really arguing that it was fair enough that the senator never thought he was British because when he became a citizen of Australia in 1974, Britain wasn't considered a foreign power. Now, in 1999, the High Court decided that Britain actually was a foreign power. And the judges today did seem a little frustrated at these historical arguments that Malcolm Roberts' lawyer kept bringing. Several times they asked him to kind of hurry up and get on with his point as he was going through the complicated history of citizenship in the British Empire and in the early stages of the Commonwealth. And several times the judges interrupted Malcolm Roberts' lawyer and said, you know, where are you going with this? So then he moved on and the One Nation lawyers also tried to get back at the argument from the government that Malcolm Roberts should have suspected he was a dual citizen because he was born overseas. They said it was un-Australian to argue that foreign-born Australians should be treated any differently to those who were born here, like, for instance, Barnaby Joyce.
And how did that go down?
Well, it's difficult to say. I mean, the judges did interject quite a lot, but they did settle into a sort of more quiet listening state as he went on with his evidence. And then after Malcolm Roberts' lawyer wrapped up, there was an opportunity for all of the lawyers to kind of have another go and offer some reply to the arguments that have been put over the 3 days of this hearing. And what's becoming clear is that the big areas of clash here are really about whether it matters that you knew you were a citizen of another country or not. The people who are arguing for the government in particular say it should matter whether you know or not, because if you don't know that you're a citizen of a foreign power, then you couldn't possibly have your loyalty divided or split between two nations because you didn't know that you had any allegiance to that country. Whereas the contrary position being brought by Tony Windsor and by the Greens is that it should matter even if you don't know about it because your loyalty could still be, or your allegiance could be split by factors outside your control.
So do we know when we're going to get a final decision on this?
Well, at the end of this third day of this hearing, the judges did make a very brief statement to give us some indication of when we might get a decision. They said the court is reserving its decision for now, and they said that they understand that they need to get a decision as soon as possible. And they said that they'll publish that reason, they'll publish their decision with or without reasons as soon as possible. And you might remember from the High Court case, the most recent High Court case, which was about whether the same-sex marriage postal survey was okay under the Constitution, they also did this. They published their judgment, and then the reason was published many weeks after because they recognised there was a need to get it done quickly. And so what they've done is they've hinted that they might do the same thing here. We might find out their judgment and then have to wait a little bit longer for the actual reasons that they made that decision, because they recognise that there's a great deal of community interest in this and that the politicians themselves are going to want to know sooner rather than later whether they're eligible to continue sitting in the Australian Parliament.
That was reporter James Elton Pym in Canberra. This is SBS World News Radio. The federal government admits it still doesn't know who managed to hack commercially sensitive information about new fighter jets and Navy vessels more than a year ago. The cyber hackers managed to steal sensitive data from an Australian defence subcontractor. Jani Blackley has more.
On the cyber frontier, it's increasingly clear that no business or government is safe. New details have emerged of a cyber attack in July last year, where hackers gained access to an Adelaide-based defence subcontractor's internal systems. Mitchell Clark from the Australian Signals Directorate told a Sydney conference the hack was extensive. The audio of him at the conference was revealed by the ABC.
The compromise was extensive and extreme, and as we'll see, most of that data was defence-related. Information on the JSF, the Joint Strike Fighter, the C-130, the P-8 Poseidon, the JDAM, that's a smart bomb, and a few Australian naval vessels.
The hackers maintained internal access to the system for around 4 months until authorities were alerted in November. Over that time, they stole 30 gigabytes of data, most of which was defence-related. Special Advisor to the Prime Minister on Cybersecurity, Alastair McGibbon, is downplaying the breach, saying none of the information was classified.
Well, there was absolutely no national security information that was contained in the systems. It was commercial in confidence, and Defence has been able to say that there was no impact whatsoever upon the systems that this company was assisting on.
He did say, however, that information hacked on the new Navy ships included a diagram in which you could zoom into the captain's chair and see that it was 1 metre away from the navigation chair. Opposition leader Bill Shorten says the breach should never have happened.
The very fact that people who shouldn't have had access to this information got access should ring alarm bells in the government, but they don't appear to have woken up to this being a problem. If we got lucky this time and it was only sensitive information, not even more significant information, we need to make sure there is no next time. The government needs to wake up to itself, start taking its responsibilities seriously and start protecting sensitive defence information.
As the Australian government increases its domestic shipbuilding capabilities, so too does the risk. The contractor involved had around 50 employees and only one IT person, and the password used on the company's system had admin as the username and guest as the password. Minister for Defence Industry Christopher Pyne says those without proper cybersecurity won't get future contracts.
But it's a very important reminder to small and medium enterprises, as well as the large contractors, that they will not get work in defence industry if their cybersecurity is not up to standard.
Mitchell Clark from the Australian Signals Directorate says the nature of the attack shows a high degree of sophistication.
It sort of shows a maturing state of, I guess, nation-state espionage, in that it's not just the old smash and grab that used to happen, you know, 5-6 years ago. It's much more methodical and slow and deliberate.
While questions remain as to who exactly was behind the attack, Special Advisor Alastair McGibbon says it may be a foreign government.
Given the nature of who was targeted, it'd be fair to assume at least that it could well be a nation state. But it's very hard to identify who and what was behind these types of things.
Special Advisor to the Prime Minister Alastair McGibbon ending that report by Jani Blackley. The United Nations says it has evidence of killings, torture and rape in northern Rakhine State. That's still to come on SBS World News Radio. International students have been put on alert with the government to roll out tougher English tests. From next year, students will need to formally pass an English course before they can enter tertiary education. Omar DeBarge reports.
Studying under the Sydney sun and escaping the Beijing smog has been a highlight for Yi Wang. The journalism master's student had to pass an English test to start her Australian studies, but admits the tests are not foolproof.
Some of my friends, they have already passed the English course at the English teaching school, but they can't speak English. They can't really speak fluent English in their daily life.
The federal government wants to stop that from happening under its new scheme. Education Minister Simon Birmingham says English language intensive courses for overseas students will have to formally assess students where they provide direct entry to a tertiary course.
The vast majority of language courses are providing high quality outcomes, which is why more than 90% of international students report high levels of satisfaction with their study experience in Australia. But some slip through the cracks, and it's unacceptable for that to occur.
The stricter standards will include at least 20 face-to-face teaching hours a week, with classes having no more than 18 students at a time. There will be a compulsory formal assessment on English language skills before students can enter a tertiary course. Minister Birmingham says for the first time, the standard will also apply to vocational and training courses like TAFE.
This is about protecting international students and ensuring that they get the education and training they deserve. Because reputation is what drives students and attracts students to Australia, and it is why we must safeguard and protect that reputation at all costs into the future.
It is also being seen as a crackdown on English colleges to prevent teachers from passing students with poor language skills. At the moment, there is no formal process to assess overseas students. They can currently pass a course, either here or overseas, without proof, and gain direct entry to university. Chief Executive of the International Education Association of Australia, Phil Honeywood, explains.
We're going one more step to ensure that Australia is seen not just as a safe and affordable study destination, but as a destination that emphasises quality in everything we do.
There are some 600,000 international students in Australia. Many are from Asia, with upwards of 90,000 from China alone. Sam Wong from the Federation of Chinese Associations of ACT believes there shouldn't be sweeping changes to a $28 billion sector based on anecdotal evidence.
I think it's a little bit overburdened for examination again. They have good proficiency and competency in English before they enter their first year study at university.
But Yi Wang welcomes a tougher test.
If the test is harder and we will study harder, for us, the rest of living in Australia will be easier because we can speak fluent English and we can fit in this place.
Student Yi Wang ending that report by Omar DeBarge. It's 20 minutes after 6. Coming up.
Everyone's ready with their drums and their, you know, the derbakes and ready to dapke and dance, you know, in the stadium and to just cheer for the Lebanon team.
Excitement builds in Sydney's Lebanese community ahead of the Rugby League World Cup. That's still to come on SBS World News Radio. The United Nations has accused Myanmar of systematically creating a climate of fear for the Rohingya Muslims. The UN human rights body has reported evidence of killings, torture and the rape of children in northern Rakhine State. Tara Cozzoletto reports.
The United Nations says Myanmar security forces have brutally driven 500,000 Rohingya Muslims out of northern Rakhine State. A UN report accuses the security forces of torching Rohingya homes, crops and villages to prevent them from returning. The report, based on 65 interviews with Rohingya refugees in Bangladesh, found what it calls clearance operations began before Rohingya militants attacked police posts in August. The Myanmar government has said the violence was in response to the attacks. The report finds the campaign was well organised, coordinated and systematic, and started with Rohingya men under the age of 40 being arrested a month earlier. It says that created a climate of fear and intimidation. Thomas Haneke from the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights says the report found evidence of killings, torture, the rape of children and the destruction of villages.
The credible information collected also indicates that the Myanmar security forces purposely destroyed the property of the Rohingya population scorched their dwellings and entire villages in northern Rakhine State, not only to drive the population out in droves, but also to prevent the fleeing Rohingya victims from returning to their homes.
The report has also found it is highly likely Myanmar security forces have planted landmines along the border in recent weeks to prevent the Rohingya from returning. Mr. Hunecki has sharply criticised the army's actions.
The destruction by the Tatmadaw of houses, fields, food stocks, crops, livestock and even trees render the possibility of the Rohingya returning to normal life and livelihoods in the future in northern Rakhine almost impossible.
Earlier this month, Bangladesh and Myanmar agreed to set up a joint working group on the repatriation of the Rohingya. The Myanmar government says anyone verified as a refugee from the country will be allowed to return under a process agreed upon with Bangladesh in 1993. The head of the Asia and Pacific region of the UN Human Rights Office, Jyoti Sangera, says there needs to be open dialogue to make sure the refugees can return safely.
In terms of the repatriation, I think the governments need to make clear what their proposals are. If there is a return to their country, they should be able to return where all of their rights, civil, political, social, economic and cultural, are protected and upheld.
The head of the Asia and Pacific region of the UN Human Rights Office, Jyoti Sangera, ending that report from Tara Cozzoletto. You're listening to SBS World News Radio. It's 24 minutes after 6. I'm Sasha Payne. It's good to have your company. Tensions continue to mount and confusion is building over the possible independence of the Spanish region of Catalonia. It's led to the Spanish Prime Minister issuing an ultimatum in a bid to move closer to a resolution. Matt Canellan reports.
Spanish Prime Minister Mariano Rajoy has given the Catalan government 5 days to clarify whether it has declared independence. And if it turns out it has, he says, Catalonia has 3 days after that to rescind the claim. Mr. Rajoy made the announcement in an address to Spain's parliament, saying he hopes Catalonia revokes any declaration of independence if it has indeed made one.
En el caso de que la respuesta sea afirmativa,
in the case of a positive answer, or there is no answer, Mr. Puigdemont will be asked to revoke the so-called Declaration of Independence. To the first question, he has as a deadline next Monday at 10 a.m. To the second one, let's hope it doesn't happen, he has as a deadline until Thursday at 10 a.m, Thursday next week.
It's the first step to activating Article 155 of the Spanish Constitution. Doing so would let Mr. Rajoy suspend Catalonia's political autonomy and take over the region. The demands of the Spanish government come after a speech earlier this week by Catalan leader Carles Puigdemont. But the Catalan Parliament Speaker, Carme Forcadell, says invoking Section 155 of the Constitution could backfire.
What I would like to say is that Article 155 would create the opposite effect that the Spanish government intends. As I have said, repression has not served to stop this democratic process. So much so, as I understand it, applying 155 would deepen the problem. It would be worse because I am sure many people are prepared to defend Catalonia's self-government. And that is the way it is. It would deepen the problem. It wouldn't be a solution. It would produce the opposite effect.
The Spanish government says the referendum in Catalonia is illegal and contravenes the constitution. So far, Mr. Rajoy has ruled out mediation to solve the crisis. Ms. Forcadell says the Spanish Prime Minister needs to solve the problem through politics.
Entonces yo creo que lo más importante es...
I think that at this moment, President Rajoy is at a historical crossroads. That is, he must decide whether he chooses dialogue and mediation or whether he will continue using repression as he has thus far. I think he has the historical responsibility of resolving a political conflict politically, and so far he has only tried to do so through the courts and through repression.
Spain has been in turmoil since the disputed referendum on October the 1st. Nearly 90% of voters backed independence, but turnout was only 43%, with anti-independence voters largely boycotting the ballot. Earlier this week, Catalan leaders signed a declaration of independence, but they halted its implementation to hold talks with the Spanish government. Pro-independence supporters in Catalonia are frustrated at the uncertainty and angry at Mr. Rajoy, as this woman explains.
He wants to apply the Article 155 either way as a reprisal against Catalans. To me, it is clear that Puigdemont wants independence, but he was asking for dialogue to prevent them from saying he didn't want to discuss it. It is impossible to talk with Rajoy, and that is why I don't know what is going to happen. Nobody knows what is going to happen.
Mariano Rajoy's move could, in the short term, deepen the divide between the Spanish government and Catalonia's. But it also signals a potential step towards resolving Spain's biggest political crisis since a failed military coup of 1981.
Matt Connellan with that report. This is SBS World News Radio. Excitement is building in Sydney's Lebanese community ahead of the Rugby League World Cup, which kicks off later this month. Players and fans are hoping to make a difference on and off the field during the tournament. Adrian Arcouli reports.
Robbie Farah has played on Rugby League's biggest stages, but the 33-year-old says representing Lebanon holds extra significance.
Well, I think off the field we've got an opportunity here to really have an influence that I probably haven't had an influence with any other jersey I've put on. Like, I think there's a really strong opportunity here for us and a strong responsibility to go out there and provide a positive impact for the Lebanese community here in Australia and back home. So in terms of the meaning of the jersey and the impact we can have on the community, I think it's massive, and I don't take that lightly.
Lebanon takes on France in Canberra before games in Sydney against Australia and England. Community ambassador Anthony Alam is expecting Lebanon to be well supported.
The Lebanese community and supporters are so passionate about the games, and we can't wait. We're looking at least 20, 30,000 Lebanese attending the games, or maybe more.
Fellow community ambassador Stephanie Musa says the Lebanese community is relishing the opportunity to see its country in a major sporting tournament.
Everyone's ready with their drums and their, you know, the derbakes, and ready to dapke and dance, you know, in the stadium and to just cheer for the Lebanon team. And I'm hearing a good few thousand that are just going to, you know, turn up and really represent and show the rest of the countries what, you know, how the Lebanese support each other.
It will provide players like Michael Leisha with the chance to learn about their heritage.
I've been listening to the anthem every day at home. I'm hopeless. I can't speak Arabic, so I've got no hope, but I've been listening to it.
The Rugby League World Cup kicks off on the 27th of October.
Adrian Arcouli with that report. This is SBS World News Radio. Before we go, a final check of today's main stories. Floods and landslides have killed at least 37 people and damaged homes and crops in northern and central Vietnam. Rival Palestinian factions Hamas and Fatah have reportedly reached a deal over political reconciliation. An international survey of around 17,000 people in 23 countries has revealed most Australians believe religion does more harm than good. And ceremonies have been held to mark 15 years since the 2002 Bali bombing, which left 202 people dead. That's SBS World News Radio for now. You can see Mike Tomalaris in a minute on SBS World News. SBS Radio features a podcast for you to listen to anytime at sbs.com.au/news. I'm Sasha Payne. Thanks for listening.